Okay, can you just tell us what is your name, what do you do, what's your background, where do you work, all that?
Okay, so my name's Clem Unger. I live in Australia in a place called Mornington, which is sort of an hour southeast of Melbourne. And as you may recognize from my accent, I'm not born in Australia, originally from Germany, and I came out here 22 years ago this year. Time flies. And my background originally is chemistry. I'm an industrial chemist, chemical engineer. I've got a little business degree on the side as well. And 20 something years ago, I made a lifestyle decision and came out to Australia to the great horror of my dad in Germany. And I'm still here and enjoying it. I'm working in a totally different field now. I'm mainly doing consulting in the non-for-profit sector area. And mainly with organizations involved in disability management. And I'm on the private side for over 14 years, and that makes me really feel old now, an amateur astronomer. So my granddad back in Germany was an avid stargazer, and that's sort of one of my earliest memories, going outside with him. And that was the times where light pollution wasn't quite what it is these days. And we had a fabulous time, and I joined the local astronomy club over there. That's back in a place called Darmstadt, which is south of Frankfurt. And never looked back. And then I came here to Australia, and first of all, you have to get obviously used to the fact that the constellations you from the north you can see from here are upside down, so it's a bit weird when you have Orion suddenly the other way around, so you need to learn your stars again down here, and especially finding the southern pole is a bit more interesting than when to align your telescope than up in the northern hemisphere. But you get the hang of it, and so fabulous. And ever since I'm in astronomy, and I'm lucky, I've got a very understanding wife who allowed me to build an observatory in my backyard. And so I've got this lovely dome out there, which allows me, weather permitting, just to go outside and do my thing and not have to set up, and worse, dismantle all your gear after a long night, and then with cold fingers drop an eyepiece, which is a bit of a pain. If anyone has the opportunity, I highly recommend it. So you get so many more hours out of it, so it's really great. So that's it in a nutshell, pretty much.
What telescope do you have in that observatory?
Sorry?
What telescope have you got in there?
I've got a 6-inch refractor in there, which I predominantly use for photography. So I take the eyepieces out. Initially I bought it to have sort of the best of both worlds, something that is still portable, even though I haven't done that for years now, and you can visually observe, but it's very, very good for planetary work, and I'm sort of hunting the odd little minor planet down, so it's really good for that. And I've got a direct drive mount, which can be a little bit temperamental. It's an Austrian ASA mount, so totally new learning curve there to get that going. And but once you master that, it rewards it with unguided exposure, so it's good, but it takes its time. So you can't drive the telescope without a computer. That's probably the downside. So I miss a little bit, you know, just if you have it in the field, plonk it down and switch it on. That you can't do this with that. That's sort of a little bit a downer, but because of the observatory, it's not happening. So I just open the dome and off we go.
I suppose you have a laptop or something set up there permanently, or
yes, I have a dome. Honestly, I would have preferred actually an observatory with a roll off roof because I didn't have the space, so I had to settle for a dome. And what I don't like with a dome is the fact that you miss out on this all sky experience. You have only this opening in the roof, and your software inside, and it tells you where you point your telescope, but you might miss out actually on a nice fireball or something like that. That's, I think, a little bit negative, and also the fact that a dome is exponentially dearer than a roll-off roof observatory. It works well, and it's nicely automated. So if you point the telescope somewhere, the dome rotates with it. And so that took a little while to get that going, but it's good. I mean, technically, I could sit inside here and do it remotely, but I think I think then I would rather subscribe to iTelescope and let it all.
It's funny, you're describing my ideal setup. Now, I remember 20, almost 30 years ago, the idea of not finding an object by eye, star hopping painfully one bit at a time, was cheating, you know? But a bit older now, sitting there getting cramps in the dew, I don't know, it's not so much fun anymore, you know?
I totally agree, but I have to say, I mean, if you have any of the planetarium softwares which link into your Mountain, SkyX, and Stellarium and whatever there is, and you just plan your observing session and then you tick it through, it's just amazing. I mean, it's come a long way, and when I think back to the times with my granddad and I had a small refractor and then a Newton at home, and you basically lugged it around and you pointed, and you star hop. That's, I mean, it's very ancient these days, and I mean, it gets people quicker into the hobby, but on the other side, you lose out a little bit because that star hopping teaches you actually where you are, whereas if you just push a button, it's not necessarily so good. So,
especially with astrophotography, you know, I have a very old mount. It's got and this is just a budget problem. It's not this is not my choice to do it the hard way. But I tell you, the amount of time I take setting up, carrying everything downstairs, getting my polar alignment right, and then the battery dies, and I haven't taken a single photo yet.
Yeah, I mean, I fondly remember when I was sitting in the deepest winter in Germany, somewhere outside, and I didn't actually at times have a mount which was driven, so I manually guided with the guide scope the mount, and obviously it was not digital cameras, it was all film, and we experimented around with hypersensitizing film with hydrogen. I'm surprised that we didn't burn the house down. and it's amazing, and now you can buy these fantastic CCD cameras which are cooled, and it's just it's a quantum leap ahead. And if you see results from people like Damien Peach, with a lot of your listeners would know, chap from the UK, does the most amazing planetary photographs with a Celestron 14, and I mean, you would have killed for that at that time. It's just unbelievable. Very professional, and I think it will continue like that. So it makes the hobby even more rewarding than it ever has been, I'd say, if it wasn't only for the light pollution, which is creeping in everywhere.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Can you tell us, I believe you are involved with the OSIRIS-REx mission. What is it?
Okay, OSIRIS-REx is a current NASA mission, which is run in conjunction with the University of Arizona, and it goes to a near asteroid with the name of Bennu, and it is a sample return mission. So the spacecraft at the moment is underway, and it is expected to arrive at the asteroid this year, mid of August, and it will then, similar to the Rosetta mission, a lot of people know, go into a very extensive survey orbit around the asteroid, and then in 2020 the whole thing will culminate in an attempt to acquire a sample from the surface, which then will hopefully be safely returned to Earth in a clone of the Stardust sample return capsule, so similar technology. And in 2023, hopefully it lands in Utah on a salt lake. So, yeah, it's exciting. Nice. And the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is OSIRIS-REx is again one of these lovely NASA acronyms. I suppose they have someone sitting in a back room similar at IKEA thinking of names probably all day long. And so it stands for Origins, Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification, Security, Regolith Explorer. So obviously, long-winded words, so OSIRIS-REx goes quicker over the tongue. So, and like NASA has domestically in the U.S. A group of what they call solar systems ambassadors, which are, it's only open to U.S. citizens, at least that's my last sort of information, but with OSIRIS-REx, the group around the principal investigator, his name's Dante Loretta from University of Arizona, decided to cast their net a little bit wider. And I mean, there is a lot of ambassadors out there, the majority, of course, in the US, but you'll find some dotted around the world. And I'm one of them here in Australia, or to my knowledge, the only one in Australia, actually. And it is thought to basically tell the general public about the mission and why it's important to send missions to a near-Earth asteroid like Bennu and what we can learn from it. And apart from the actual science, do a little bit of STEM outreach and hopefully sort of spark the interest of some young students who are in grade 7 to grade 12 here in Australia to maybe look into this as a career in space science and engineering. That there's actually something out there you can make a career out of. So, and that's what I'm doing predominantly. I go to schools. Most of my talks are in schools, and it's quite nice to see it when the kids look at the presentation, and I've got lots of videos in it. So the launch of the mission, and the research group has a fabulous assortment of educational short videos you can use, how the sample will be acquired and so on. And so you can captivate the audience nicely with that, and it's very rewarding. So I do that pro bono, so it's my hobby, and you get something out of it, and it's very enjoyable.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, everything I'm doing here, this podcast and the website also, it's just to, you know, just to share what we do and get people excited about it. And
but it's important because it's astronomy. That's sort of an observation I made around here. It's sort of the poor relative. I mean, it's not much mentioned in school, and you find when you approach science staff and you tell them about it, they're usually excited. They jump on it because there is not much out there, not many other incursions happen at schools, and unfortunately the science teachers are not always very experienced when it comes to astronomy. So I hope to, you know, wake some interest there as well. And if you pass, say, a meteorite around in the room, and people, the students can take it in their hand, and it's, you know, you say, look, this is actually probably the oldest thing you ever held in your hand. You know, it's a few billion years old. And that's usually, you know, when you see the penny drop sometimes with some kids, and it's really fun, and I like it. And and I hope I will have in the future always time to do it, because obviously school and normal work often is at the same time. So but I've been fortunate to be able to set some time aside for it.
Mm-hmm. Are there, well, let me rephrase it. So with the mission, you mentioned when the craft is arriving and that thing. Are there any other highlights that are worth watching out for? Like interesting times when there's going to be information coming out or footage that we can see?
I mean, definitely what I would follow on the OSIRIS-REx website, which is asteroidmission.org, and is the arrival of the probe in August, because at the moment Bennu is, like most other asteroids, just a dot in a star field. And so it will be quite exciting when the spacecraft actually is on approach, and similar, like you know, Pluto and the Dawn mission at Vesta and Ceres. You actually suddenly you get every day you get a better image, and I expect that to happen, and it will be really exciting to actually see what the surface structure of Bennu.
So it does have a camera on board, like, then. I know some missions they don't for some reason.
Yeah, like Juno, where actually the camera was an afterthought to put it on. So I think for all space missions, just to get this public buy-in, I do believe there has to be a camera on board. And when it comes to OSIRIS-REx, there is a very extensive camera suite on board, which will really analyze the surface and composition of the asteroid very, very closely, because the composition is important. We want to know what Bennu can tell us, because it's a a near-Earth asteroid. It's a carbonaceous asteroid, so one of the rarer sort. And it comes every 6 years close to Earth. And there is a remote possibility that it could get even closer and strike Earth. Very remote chance, but still. And as of the moment, we obviously, as humans, have no means of deflecting an asteroid. And the more we know about them, and the more we learn down the track, we obviously can hopefully do something about it. And Bennu is one of these candidates. It's about 500 meters in diameter. It has roughly the shape of a walnut, and rotates once in four and a half hours roughly. And so if something like that hits us, that can really ruin your day. So the more we know, the better it is. So hence OSIRIS-REx is one of these key missions that are important to learn about these near-Earth objects. And there is a few other missions out there. I mean, you've got currently the Japanese mission Hayabusa mm-hmm. out there similar. So you can sort of deduct the trend a little bit. So I think the reality that if something like that happens and the consequences has sunk in with the decision makers, and it's a good thing. So to send these missions out there and learn, and hopefully come up with a solution, what we can do to prevent an asteroid strike, which would be really not good for us at the moment.
When we were chatting a few days or a few weeks ago, I was asking about, you know, citizen science projects, and you mentioned Target Asteroid. How much do you know about that?
Target Asteroids is a program. It's run by the same research group, and it reaches out to amateurs who have equipment sort of 8-inch telescopes and up, and do observations photographically of a selected target list of asteroids and report their observations back to the team, because you just don't get the manpower with professional observatories to verify orbits, etc., of asteroids. And that's where amateurs have a really, really good place in science and research. And these research teams are really grateful for amateurs, and you can make a really meaningful contribution to our hobby and astronomy as a whole. So it's a good thing. It's very rewarding. You obviously need to have equipment of a certain size, but just by some of the people I know and I'm familiar with, that's not a problem. It's more the dedication of time and going out there and take the photos. But it's called Target Asteroids. There's links also via the Asteroid Mission website. So I'm sure that the team will be grateful if some people might have a look at it.
Great, thanks. Just a bit of a sidetrack here. It just occurred to me while you were talking earlier about your work with the OSIRIS-REx and visiting schools and so on. Mm. Have you ever had people like moon landing deniers and flat earth types confront you about this, asking you to confess that you're that you're making it all up or some such nonsense?
Actually, I have to say, not so much in schools. I think they've got their head all screwed on the right way, and I think especially the kids, which are really networked these days, I think they believe it because they're all very tech savvy, and so the fact that someone, you know, can go up to the moon and walk around on it, that's definitely is not questioned. I think I get it more with some of the older audience I've got. One of my hobbies or pastimes is I collect sort of space memorabilia, so if I can afford it, that is, and so like flown artifacts from Apollo missions and so on, and every now and then you get it. And so I said, do you think they really were there? And I said, yeah, yes, they actually were. And it's, it amazes me that, you would be able to, first of all, get a fake story like that past the almost 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo missions, for starters, and then past the Russian competitors who very closely looked what was going on. I mean, it would have been
and they actually congratulated them afterwards. You know, why absolutely. Would they do that if they?
I mean, nothing would have been better than they finding out it was all happening somewhere in the American desert somewhere. So of course it's real, and I've been fortunate to meet some moonwalkers, and every time you actually in the presence of someone like that, they are. It's a special type of person, or any astronaut as a matter. So like Chris Hadfield and so on, they have this aura of, they don't have to prove anything around them. And I find that immensely inspiring. To walk up to, Buzz Aldrin and tell him it's all a fake, I think is just an insult. So yeah,
I believe he's treated it as an insult. Didn't he punch that guy out? Yeah, they kept harassing him, and eventually he lost his temper.
he floored someone, and that was I think he was a bit younger then. I've seen him a couple of times, and he's very opinionated, and he's got an awful lot of experience, and so I think also as respect for his colleagues from Apollo 1 who gave their lives or lost their lives in the pursuit of getting there, I think of course it's an insult, and you don't want to hear stuff like that. So I mean, if you look at it this way, with the gear they had and what's out there now, they went to the moon and back, and the computing power in the average smartphone is better than what they had in the command module. So hello, I mean, that's amazing. It takes balls and a special type of person to do that.
Yeah. If people want to know more or be kept up to date, or where can people go to learn more? Or
well, first of all, astronomy in general. If you're in South Africa, talk to Alan. if there is a local astronomy club wherever you are, have a look and speak to them. Usually these people are very friendly, and especially if you're new to the hobby, go there and you get a helping hand, especially if you consider buying telescope. It's always good if you have someone who's experienced to help you to avoid these initial mistakes and buying something wrong and then being disappointed and starting the hobby the wrong way. If you're interested in OSIRIS-REx, have a look at the mission website. I mentioned it earlier. It's www.asteroidmission.org. And there's plenty of information on there, inclusive mission overviews, what the spacecraft looks like, key dates of the mission, and of course news updates when something new happens. So as I mentioned, August is sort of a key milestone this year when the spacecraft arrives at the asteroid. Definitely have a look there. And yeah, NASA maps website, nasa.org, good sort of entry point in having a look around what's going on out there. And if anyone is interested in talking to me, if you're in Australia, but anywhere really, I'd say I give my contact details to Alan. So if someone's interested, contact Alan, and I'd be more than happy to chat and take it from there.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. It's been great chatting to you.
Absolute pleasure.